Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. A couple of generations ago, all across Middle America, Sunday dinner at home was the big meal of the week, and a mother or grandmother would fry up a chicken. The fact that this ritual has virtually disappeared in a couple of generations is the subject that intrigues and inspires my guest today to write. Mark Brown is the managing editor of This Land Press, but it was his assignment at the Tulsa World, writing about food for nearly a decade and a year in southwest France, that inspired him to begin writing seriously about food and culture. Brown started a quarterly journal in early 2002 called Argent Fork, a publication where he could ruminate on Ike's Chili or the Tulsa Coney or trying to reproduce southwestern French local cuisine here in Tulsa, worry about the lost traditions of frying a chicken, or living in a truly local food economy. His new book, My Mother is a Chicken, Essays on Eating and Drinking, are taken from the output of Argent Fork as the publication celebrates its 10th anniversary. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Mark Brown, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit how you got started doing Argent Fork, which the book of essays is taken from. Was this just your passion, sort of your writing outlet, or what exactly?
Well, I'd been covering food as a reporter at the Tulsa World, where I worked for a good many years, about a decade, up to 2001. I'd been an editor and a designer largely and decided there was an opening, and I decided that I wanted to take the food beat. Now, this is not the restaurant beat, so I wasn't really a critic. So I got to explore. It was fairly uncharted territory in some ways, and I just got to explore topics. And as I decided on these weekly feature ventures, I realized that I had a very distinct curiosity about this world of cooking and eating and so on and so forth. Then I took a sabbatical for a year with my wife, and we went to the poorest region in France, southern France, very near Spain along the Mediterranean coast.
It's the Languedoc?
The Languedoc would be the large region, and then we lived in a very small wine town called Saint-Chinian. And there I got to explore even more, further, and all that Mediterranean tradition and the wine and the cooking that go hand in hand. And that's where Argent Fork came from. Basically, a year back in the States, absorbing it and realizing I needed to continue my food writing and not really wanting to do it in a traditional way.
Yeah, this is a very different style than you would see in the newspaper.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. It's more personal experience combined with
more memoir, more experimentation, a little racier at times. I leave it all open. Yeah.
Well, the book opens with a wonderful essay. It's called The Peanut Farmer, and it's talking about your own family heritage, a grandfather.
Correct,
right?
Correct. My mother's dad.
Had a farm down around somewhere around Pittsburgh County. Right. And the purpose of the essay is, it's kind of interesting from a foodie. It's like your childhood rejection of whole foods and homemade foods, which is the whole basis of being a foodie, and how as a child it's, you kind of said, I'm not going near that with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, it's the full circle aspects of learning to eat right again.
Right.
Is a kind of interesting, that's the theme of that one. It's the generational leaps that tend to occur. He made everything from growing sweet potatoes to killing hogs, and his daughter, my mother, moved to town and started cooking, not always out of a box, but the boxes became too tempting, I would think, to a woman who had been growing up on the farm and seeing all of the time and effort it took to actually put food on the table. So she would buy canned peaches and rice-a-roni and occasionally, and more often than not, do the traditional dish, and she cooked quite well. It's just, I have to think that reaction that we're having today of wanting to go back to the original source is a reaction to that era that she became a cook in, and that is the packaged foods.
Well, so, of course, and that was the miracle thing, which it freed people from being in the kitchen all day and basically planning your day around what you're going to eat, because it took all day to prepare or preparation for a whole season of food in canning or, doing whatever you have to do to make sure there's always food on the table.
Precisely. I saw some of those, routines repetitions occur in France, where it seems like you're always thinking about food. You're either buying it, you're either thinking about buying it or thinking about cooking it, or you're eating it, or you're talking about when you're going to do that all over again. So that cycle is just a repetitive thing that takes up way more time than you would think conscionable as an adult. But
yeah, I think the only time I ever experienced that is either vacation, but especially when you're camping. Camping, it's all about, okay, what are we going to have for breakfast? What are we going to have for dinner? And so, you know, it's always thinking about,
absolutely, yeah,
you know, about how you're going to, you know, what food to pack along with you as you take along, you know, yeah, this sort of thing.
Well, you're having to bring the kitchen with you. And,
yeah, bring the kitchen.
The survival instinct kicks in, and and you're hungry, you're out there because you're active. And, yeah.
Well, this piece of peanut farmer, I mean, he grew peanuts, right? And
right,
you had that taste of raw peanuts.
Yes.
And he would make his own peanut butter.
It's, you know, that the kind of that
sorghum,
off-white color, you know,
yeah,
not the
uh-huh,
Peter Pan color,
yeah,
but the kind of unnatural color, where as a kid, mm-hmm, you go, whoa, that's, where's the yellow lid and where's the strange brown color and where's the smoothness? You know, it was just so, you wish that you could have recognized it then for what it was, but too young.
Churned his own butter?
He did. Threw foil-wrapped yams into the fireplace. I saw him kill a turkey once with a hatchet. Just everything about what went into his cooking and eating occurred right there within that vicinity.
Yeah. Another essay, the title essay of the book, My Mother is a Chicken, reflects on maybe the same grandma or maybe the other grandmother's fried chicken.
Well, it actually starts with his wife's, mm-hmm, fried chicken, and which then becomes my mother's fried chicken, right?
Yeah.
It stopped there. I think if you gleaned this from the essay, it's that I did not get that fried chicken gene. I'm not able to replicate it in the same way. I don't know if it's not from lack of practice. So something's skipped a generation, and maybe one of my kids will pick it back up, but people have asked me about the title, and it is an awkward sort of title, I guess. But
no, it's quirky, you know.
Yeah,
fun.
You know, and
it's
you fun. Have to have that, right? Yeah. You got to have something to latch onto. But I just realized that there wasn't really any clear line anymore between my mother and that dish. That when I thought about the dish and I thought about her, they had consumed a similar space, and where food and body are sort of.
We're probably close to the same age, and I think this is universal. It's for people who grew up in Oklahoma, fried chicken was the Sunday dinner.
Sure.
When we were kids.
Right.
And all of a sudden, fried chicken became so messy, and it's so, you know, it's hard to clean up after, and all of a sudden, it's fallen by the wayside, and we really don't know how to fry chicken anymore.
No.
And it's, you know, from the Colonel or from Church's or somebody else or Popeye's, and that's not the fried chicken we're talking about. In fact, the fried chicken we're talking about has become like these mecca restaurants where they still do it, like, you know, Willie Mae's Scotch House in New Orleans.
And, precisely, and places, yeah.
And, you know, these are places people will travel for 100 yeah, miles to go eat fried chicken at.
Right.
Or the AQ Chicken House in Rogers.
Yeah. A lot of times the best fried chicken isn't done by a place that cooks fried chicken. It's done by a cook who understands fried chicken, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just part of the repertoire.
So why do you suppose that has gotten out of our repertoire, since it's such a part of, like, if you're a lifelong Oklahoman, you know, and you,
sure,
you probably grew up with that.
Well, it's probably a couple of things. I mean, there's really no family table anymore. Less and less, I should say. The Sunday dinner, that concept has been taken over by the NFL. I think partly what we're dealing with on something like fried chicken is, which can you eat easier in a car? a breast with a bone in and a leg that you have to somehow navigate? Or are we going to be able to pull into the any of the ubiquitous fried chicken drive-thrus and grab a little box of nuggets? Yeah. I mean, that's really it.
Yeah, or a boneless chicken. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, a strip.
Yeah.
I think there was a line in the essay saying, you know, when did pick of the chick become a strip of breast meat?
Yeah, I did. That tender.
It used to be it used to be the drumstick, right?
Sure. Yeah. It's funny how with the changing tastes and habits, also appetites. You know.
My guest today is Mark Brown, the managing editor of This Land Press, a former writer for the Tulsa World. And he publishes Argent Fork, a food and drink quarterly. And he has a new book out titled My Mother is a Chicken, Essays on Eating and Drinking. It's taken from the pages, first decade of Argent Fork. And the second essay is basically detailing that year in southwestern France. How did that open your eyes as far as seeing food differently?
Seasons. Really? Yeah, seasons are a big
thing. The essay is set into seasons. Yeah.
Right. We arrived very near Christmas and left almost a year to the day, so I got to see all four. And the way that fruit comes through the produce markets, the market stalls, You walk up for these, there were these glorious peaches that came in June, I think it was, and they had a color like none other, almost like a circus peanut color, very even, light orange all the way through, none of that rosy blush that you get on a peach like that we're used to seeing. And I became enamored with them, and their flavor was incredible, and they lasted about 10 days. And I went back one day to get them, and they were gone. And the woman gave me this response like, but that's the way they do it. They come and they go. And I realized that the same thing was happening with strawberries, and the same thing was happening with, well, any number of dishes. So,
and that's our supermarket culture. We expect to have something. And the thing about it is we sacrifice so much flavor.
Sure.
Because those 10 days were when those peaches were ready to be picked, and they were ripe, and they were plush and,
right,
you know, just one full of flavor.
Yeah, that's the eating process. And I guess if there's a theme, a large theme to this book and to my Argent Fork essays in general, it's that I'm still sort of in shock at how quickly we're willing to jettison flavor. It's the reason, well, I was going to say it's the reason we eat. I guess it's the reason why I eat and the reason a lot of people eat. But then there's the sustenance side and there's the have to get through it side. But you can only glean so much out of that before you become robotic. And people ultimately want something that tastes good. But those little steps we take away from that become big steps over time to where I think we lose track of the model, you know, the standard.
And I think, you know, you nailed it on the head. It's like the farmer's market is where you see this.
Sure.
You know, for the most part. And here in Tulsa, we have a nascent farmer's market growing, but you know, it's not like European countries or even big Eastern cities where everybody knows that, well, around here, you know, the first week of August, the first or second week of August, that's the time to get the sweet hatch chilies,
absolutely,
the green chilies from,
yeah,
New Mexico. And they're only going to be around for about a week, and then they're going to turn hot and bitter.
Yeah, and you have to learn those rhythms, and you have to learn to appreciate that, and you learn to have to rope that off in your mind that that's part of what we do in August. And that's the difference in the culture. When you're a pop culture, you tend to focus on other things, but people who are used to eating, like the people that I saw in southern France and elsewhere, the Italians are fairly passionate about this too, and the Spanish, they wait for seasons, and that all they want to talk about are these things. You know, it's what drives them.
And beyond food was, I mean, you're living in one of the more depressed areas of the French economy. You found people who are eating really well with not a lot of money, too.
Sure. Their ingredients are so basic. And, you know, we have chicken that's cheap. Well, they have duck that's cheap. And they have cheese that they give away practically. Even the wine was, we were shocked at the prices. And there are cooperatives for wine, too, because there's just grapevines everywhere. And so tends to make the things that we focus on as culinary things, tends to make those very affordable. Olives, for instance. It's just in fish and on and on and on, the whole Mediterranean roundup. But what's really interesting is how little they recognize the territory that they have. The treasure that it is. When I would look up to the hills and I would look out over the valley toward the sea and I would tell them that they basically had California and they didn't know it. And they looked at me and laughed. Like, oh, you've lost your mind, you know. But they do. They have that.
Do they look up to other areas like Bordeaux or Provence or Burgundy or, you know, some of the more famous culinary areas?
The
Lyon.
What happens is the elders, the ones who have been making the wine, contributing their fruit to the co-op for so many years, will always remind you that the Burgundians, on occasion, will have to come south to get enough fruit to be able to make their clandestine Burgundies. There's a lot of myth to that and lore to that, but it actually happened at one point, and they will never forget it or let you forget it. But what's not happening is the youth are not buying into it. They're moving to the cities, like all youth. So traditions are leaving, and you know, that's just the way things work.
There's an essay that sort of reflects on that year in the Languedoc. As you try to create a cassoulet that you probably had there here in this part of the country, and trying to find pork belly from a butcher, not an easy test. The essay is called A Quest for Cassoulet, and the simple ingredients are hard to find.
They're elusive at best.
And like lard. I mean, you have to go to Mexican grocery. I know you can find a Mexican grocery. You can find lard.
Sure. And you can actually find it at Reeser's on occasion.
Yeah.
But to find the belly, I had to go to Nam Hai, which is the Asian market out east. And I'll never forget the first one I bought. It was wrapped in one of those little pink styrofoam trays with cellophane over it, and the cellophane had split on two of the corners, and the belly was kind of poking out. And I sniffed it. I tried to get some idea about its freshness, and I tend to not denigrate the market, despite the fact you walk through the door out there and you're immediately challenged by aromas and all those sorts of things.
There is a smell there.
Yeah, but I think Asian grandmothers are eating this stuff, so right. It's got to be good, right? But at the same time, there's this idea that I'm making a classic Southern French dish using a belly I bought at an Asian market in East Tulsa. So it's you have to adapt.
Could you replicate what you had in Southern France?
No. You can't replicate what time puts in. And the centuries of perfecting a dish and knowing what ingredients go when and where and knowing how to layer things and knowing the smell versus looking at the clock when something is done. Mm-hmm. All those things take a lot of experience, and I don't have that.
Yeah. And of course, the ingredients, even, like sausages and things like that, you have people who've, generations of experience. And I think, as you wrote, it says, we had one person in town who could make a very spicy Portuguese sausage. And of course, that's probably the reason he went out of business, because people couldn't appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sadness about that craft, notion of food, is that you put yourself out there on the line and you do your best to market your passion. And the quality and the integrity of the dish is really only secondary in our food world, sadly.
My guest today is Mark Brown, the managing editor of This Land Press. He publishes Argent Fork, a food and drink quarterly. He's taken essays from that publication to create My Mother is a Chicken, Essays on Eating and Drinking. It's a new book by my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Well, some of the essays also sort of reflect on our part of the country's culinary heritage. And you kind of write some essays about some people who have sort of honed that culinary heritage. And I think when you think of Tulsa, you think of things like Ike's Chili or the Coney Islander or the Coney Island, in this case, the Coney Island Hot Wiener Shop, which you write about. But let's talk in the broader sense. What is our culinary heritage in this part of the country? Have you figured it out yet?
A lot of it's largely imported. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten over the fact that it was Greeks who had to introduce chili to Tulsa. I mean, it's just and hot dogs, but they were all fighting over chili back in those days, right? And Isaac Johnson, of course, he brought his up from that southern Texas near San Antonio scrap of earth, and so there's that aspect to the heritage too. But why the Greeks? How on earth did that happen? I tell why, but it shocked me to find that out.
So. Well, why don't you tell us?
Let's do that. Well, Greeks, like anybody else, come through New York in the early 20th century, I guess, and they're all looking for a thing to do. They're all having to send money back home to people that they've left behind. So they start looking for a venture. And some of the Greeks in Tulsa history, economus, latched onto the Nathan's hot dog concept. And like anything that's popular, it gets replicated, and they just went west with it. I think they went through Cincinnati, they went through somewhere in Wisconsin, I think, moved on down through to the south. Several of them went on through Texas, but Chris Economou stayed here, and that's the Coney that we have today.
Yeah, and I guess all the others followed suit over the years, because we have a lot of Coney shops.
We have a lot of Coney shops, so they just keep mimicking each other.
Yeah, and it's the same sort of meat chili.
Sure.
Mustard, onions, and a pretty small wiener.
A little wiener tucked in there. It gets smaller and smaller every year. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. I was struck by something. It might have been either the Ikes, part of the Ikes clan or the Economos, but they were talking about how the meat has changed and the fact that they know the difference between when meat was fed on grass and now it's all, grain fed.
Yeah, I found that to really be fascinating. That was Selma Johnson, who was Preston Johnson's widow, Preston being one of Ike's nephews. It's an almost amazing family tree that if I talk too much about it, I'm going to get my tongue wrapped up. But they're the ones that opened the shop on Harvard, about 36th, among others. But that's the one that I remember. And she's the one that made the meat comment. And I found that kind of fascinating, because I don't really think about meat when I think about chili. I mean, by the time chili's finished, it's all been sort of amalgamated into something.
Yeah, it's like a meat risotto or something.
Precisely, and so the idea that the meat could actually compete in that bed of chili and onion and spice, I just didn't know that was really the case. But she's convinced, was convinced. She died recently at like 104, I think. So, mm-hmm. You know, eating chili every week.
Right. And of course, you talk about this one point where there was this confluence where Ike's and the Coney Island Hot Wiener Shop and there was some other business where like they had a common alley
they
between them.
Alley, yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell us that story.
Well, it's almost an unfathomable idea anymore when largely the Tulsa restaurant population
was downtown.
Yeah. I mean, that just doesn't, you know, to think that there would be one on every corner or four on every block and, you know, mostly parlor type setups, right? But very interchangeable kinds of cuisine. And the Ike's chili, who told me this was Jim Economou, who's Chris's son. The Ike's people shared an alley with the Coney Island people. And their cooks would go back in on their breaks and share cigarettes and share drinks and apparently recipes. And it's just funny to think that they would care enough about that there would be one person thinking, God, if we could really steal that recipe somehow, then, you know, we could change everything. I didn't know chili had such, you know, high esteem in that kind of realm. But that's our food. I mean, that's the one thing, I guess. Jim told me this whole operation runs around chili, and I thought it ran around pink meat. You know, so what do I know?
You also have an essay about barbecue to the rescue. And that's kind of interesting because we're sort of in the middle between, you know, Texas brisket, Kansas City ribs, Memphis barbecue, but we have our own, you know, we have that Oklahoma sweet, I think.
Yeah, I had to wrestle through that issue because, yeah, just in that triangulation of the big capitals of barbecue, Oklahoma sits on one side of the triangle, and, you know, you have to resolve yourself to how much of it are we adopting and how much of it are we creating. And I think having a food legacy allows you a certain flexibility. You get to take certain choices and move in a certain direction. And you're always going to be stealing from the past, or maybe acknowledging the past is a better way of putting it. But it's who you are and what you're doing and who you're serving that will ultimately indicate what's going to appear on the plate. That's not always a good thing, but it's reflected. Somehow our tastes become what ends up being cooked.
Mm. Well, in our case, you talk about several road trips. And, you know, when I think about barbecue, I lament the ones that aren't there anymore, like Pete's up on 36th Street North.
One that of my was, favorites.
Yeah, and those little sweet potato pies that they used to.
God.
Oh, those were great. And, well, anyway.
You're taking me back.
Mark Brown is my guest, the managing editor of This Land Press. His new book is titled My Mother is a Chicken, Essays on Eating and Drinking. What excites you about Tulsa food today that you're likely to write about in Argent Fork?
Well, I have two young kids, and I like to cook. And trying to figure out how to cook for my wife and I, who do not have 6 and 8 year old palates, and trying to get them taken care of, and all they want to eat is pasta with red sauce, I have to somehow spend way much more time thinking about this and dealing with this because it really is like cooking two separate meals. And then in that process of trying to think of all the things that I'm missing, I start to make up for the deficit of going out into restaurants by experimenting on my own. So I spend a lot of time buying food versus, maybe I should say, I spend a lot of time buying retail food versus restaurant food. And so long story short, I don't feel like I'm very versed in that area, but I'm excited about some of the food truck stuff mm-hmm. that's moving in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun things going on there. There's some great restaurant cooks in town, no doubt about it. I think one of them, Justin Thompson, was just recently featured in Savour magazine. There's some exciting things going on, but I just don't keep up with it like I should.
So you're busy.
I like to cook.
Trying to become a better cook yourself.
Yeah. It stays home. I have no plans to take it elsewhere, but it's just when you like to cook, it's really difficult to go out there and spend a whole lot of time in a restaurant.
Well, my advice to you would be to let your kids eat what you're eating.
I think that's probably where I'm headed.
You know, because when they get hungry enough, they'll eat it, and then they'll say, oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah, we're getting there. And we've been dabbling in that over the years, but I think you may be right, Rich.
Well, tell us a little about Argent Fork. This is a quarterly publication. It's a print edition, and I guess it's spread by word of mouth. How did you get the word out? Did you start just sending it to friends at first?
Yeah, I sent the first edition to just people I knew who I thought might be intrigued. People who over the years had told me that they admired my writing in the world, or they just friends who, hey, I love the way you described that martini that you had at Galatoire's or whatever. I would take their little nuggets of appreciation, and I added it all up and realized that I had something of a mailing list. And it just started, and I would send it out to anybody I would meet, when I would go on trips, or friends of mine who had relocated. Ironically, more than half of the mailing list, even from the beginning, have been to expats. So I have a lot of friends who left town, and like we all do. And that became the bulk of it, which creates a really interesting kind of dynamic, because it looks a lot more popular than it really is, you know. So when it's going to Barcelona and Seattle and Orange County, California, and then you know, Broken Arrow. So, but it's I haven't spent a lot of time marketing it. It's small. It's 8 pages on a 8.5 by 11 that I design myself, write and design everything. I get some photo help on the end from my wife, who takes pictures, and it's something I just love to create.
Is it pretty much your quirks about what you're thinking about food and I assume a little bit about travel as well?
Yeah, I bring everything into it. What I do is I try to find a topic, and then all bets are off at that point. It's reading, it's travel, it's memoir, it's interviews. I mean, I do some reporting on most of it. The best ones, I think, have the most reporting in them.
And most, I would say, the best essays here, you're telling us a little bit of history, too.
Sure, yeah. That's where all the reading comes in.
Yeah. And how has that changed your view of food, just doing research on going back, say, learning about all different kinds of chocolate and sure. how chocolate is actually made and where it comes from, the cacao bean? And
yeah, you know, when you realize that chocolate began as a drink, unsugared,
right,
in Aztec culture, and before that even.
And then what did the Spanish explorers say? It says this is fit to
pigs, exactly.
Yeah, the pigs.
And now we have Hershey. So that leap is what intrigues me. And I think an essay that didn't make it in here is one I wrote on pears. I've always been intrigued by pears. They have a romantic aspect about them. And, you know, you can choose from maybe one of six varieties in your local market. Well, I picked up a very interesting, old, ancient, not well-written tome on pears. But it included some 600 or so varieties and made very clear that this was only the beginning. And that's what you learn when you start to look backward, is how this culture has whittled it down. Not always in the best case scenario. You know, not always making the best choices. We like to think about our food as things that travel well versus taste well. So some of the great pears have been left behind, and everything else too. So
just like when you buy a rose, you know, it looks good. It doesn't necessarily smell good anymore.
And when you have a rose without smell, it's like having, you know, a pear without flavor.
Yeah. Mark Brown, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's been fun.
Mark Brown is the author of My Mother is a Chicken, Essays on Eating and Drinking. And he also publishes Argent Fork, a food and drink quarterly. He's also the managing editor of This Land Press, and you can find the book at thislandpress.com/store. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.